I don't particularly dig reading it, y'all, but first let me, I'm going to read a couple little things to you here in a minute, but first let me kind of finish up this presentation here real quick. So Shaktas are devoted to the Tantric, and the Tantras are actually ancient texts. Y'all are ancient texts that make use of esoteric worship of the divine feminine. Tantric has also come here. If you go to some of the temples in India, the ones that are dedicated to the mother and to Tantric Shakta worship, you will see lots of engravings of people having sex. And so there was a book that a lot of people know about called the Kama Sutra that has all these different sexual positions in it, and they're all actually there they're there to increase your physical pleasure, but they're also there to actually be forms of worship of the divine. So keep that in mind. Maya is an interesting notion here. Of course, not Maya, the natives of Central America, but Maya is the attractive but illusory physical world. It's the illusion of things. Now, the Shaivas worship Shiva. Notice here... worship of Shiva, there's a number of things. You know, there used to be a case, I made a bet with my friends that I wouldn't cut my hair, and I didn't cut my hair for 7 years, and I have really naturally curly hair, so I dread it. And one of the things I found out when all that was going on, I mean, by the time I cut it off, I looked like the Cowardly Lion. I had dreadlocks that were like this long. And but one of the things I found out is I was interacting with my Rastafarian friends, and I was interacting with my Hindu friends, is that if you look at Shiva, see how his hair is all piled up on top of his head? Those are dreadlocks. And actually, all of the Indian ascetics, when they go off into the forest, they never cut their hair anymore, and their hair slowly mats into these locks, right? Well, Jamaica actually used to be a colony of Great Britain. And there was an exchange there among the people who'd originally been brought to Jamaica as slaves, and of course Indians, because of the presence of India in the British Empire, lots of Indians immigrated over throughout the British Empire, and including Jamaica. And so one of the things that happened in a kind of cultural exchange is that some people, descendants from Africans, were reminded of the fact that Africans often wear their hair in dreadlocks by the fact that there were these Indian holy men, because these practices follow Indians wherever they go, who had gone off and wandered into the jungle and stopped doing anything but living for liberation and never cut their hair, and they had all these dreadlocks. And so there was this sort of this reminiscence and exchange. Anyway, cultural exchange. But you'll notice also whenever you see these pictures of Shiva coming out of his dreadlocks, there's always a spout of water. That's the Ganga, the Ganges River, spouting from his head. The goddess Ganga lives in his dreadlocks. Ganga lives in his dreadlocks, not Ganga. That's Australian. The goddess Ganga lives in his dreadlocks. And he's the god, as it says here, of ascetics and yogis, because he is himself an ascetic and a yogi. He spends most of his time meditating. When he's not dancing the creation of the world and dancing the destruction of the world, he's sitting in a meditative posture. He is also masculine and feminine. So in some instances, he's his own wife or his own husband, depending on how you... Yes, ma'am. Zeus is parallel in Indian mythology is Indra, but Zeus actually had that ability to. I mean, he gave birth to two children.
Out of his leg, right?
What?
Out of his leg, Artemis and Apollo.
No, he gave birth to Dionysius out of his leg. That's next to his crotch, and so Dionysius is a god of sexuality and having a good time, and he gave birth to Athena out of his head, and she's a goddess of. This is something very important if you think about this. Athena is the goddess of wisdom and strategy. So that's the reason why she's always in armor.
Oh, Leto had.
Okay, so anyways, here you'll see behind him his masculine... the lingam is just his penis. And really, when you see these... And you see these all over India, and these go back I showed you those stamps that have what's called the Proto Shiva on them. These lingam and yoni go back to probably before the Indus Valley civilization. So here is the vulva, and here is the penis penetrating the vulva. So it's life. The cosmic matrix of life. And so what Hindus will often do with these is they'll pour butter and oil and things over the top of it as an offering. Right? And there are special celebrations that celebrate the continuance of the cosmos. In the defeating of chaos and disorder. The reason I'm not going quickly on to stuff is that this to me, this is all stuff that's extremely important. This stuff happens in religious iconography way more than people realize it does. And I think that it's really kind of cool. If you actually stop and you look at Turkish... site, which was the home probably of the oldest standing stones, the recreations of what we've been able to put together based on the archaeology, it looks like the Yanni down there. And there's probably something to be said about what these standing stones actually do that's related to this.
Well, doesn't the arm represent life too?
Well, it's the same symbol actually. People don't realize it, but this is the penis.
Yeah.
And this is the entry, and this is the womb. And then, of course, it translates into Christian iconography. You see it especially in Celtic crosses and stuff. They're at the center of the world. Obviously, in one sense, it's a halo, but in another sense, it's actually the penetration of life in the world. And here in the Wheel of Dharma in Buddhism, it re-represents itself again with... I would challenge you to wander around and look at the world and not look... at the world like a Freudian trying to find people obsessed with sex, but simply look at the world and see how often the way that we choose to lay things out mirrors these structures. Okay. So last little thing here before we talk about bhakti, segues into bhakti really, the Vaishnavas, which are the worshippers of Vishnu. I said it's important to recognize Vishnu as an or- is an ordering deity who incarnates in the world. Right, so that's what these avatars are. And the avatar, the Sanskrit avatarana, which means descent, so it's a kind of descending into the world. The word actually means out, off, away. To cry, and then the vatar means to cross over, to tere, from Pino-European, to cross over. So the idea here, of course, is that the avatar is the one who crosses over into the physical realm. I think it's an interesting mirror that our avatars cross over into the virtual world. Right? And it's actually, now that's a whole other issue, and I'm not going to get totally off on that, but at some point we might talk about what's called the society of control and the networks of exchange in which we participate by actually being our physical selves and having these avatars inside the financial markets and inside the web, which are our representation inside virtual reality. Now, you'll recall the other day I said that one thing that makes it difficult for Hinduism to be replaced or to be converted away from or things like that is that it has a kind of pliability and porosity to it that allow other religions to sort of find themselves encapsulated in it. So these are the 10 incarnations, the Dashavatara, the 10 incarnations of Vishnu, Dash, DS, 10, if you speak Spanish, DS, 10, Dashavatara, the 10 incarnations of Vishnu, and you'll see here in this participant, this is just two different posters. Up there is Buddha, and I think there's Buddha there. No, wait, there's Buddha. So this is one of the ways that that Hinduism re-encapsulated Buddhist tradition to a certain extent, and one of the reasons why Buddhism actually became not as practiced in India as time went by. Right? It wasn't that there weren't still monasteries and there weren't still what you'd call traditional Buddhists. They just shrunk and shrunk and shrunk because Hinduism incorporated them in. And there are actually some of these you can find that would show Jesus as an avatar of Vishnu. Right? This avatar here, the one who rides a horse, is called Kalki. K-A-L-K-I, Kalki. And he's the avatar to come. So the end of the world, you know, the end of the world is happening. The Kali Yuga is coming down, winding down to its last little bit of corruption when Kalki shows up. Okay. So we have these major philosophical systems in India. The oldest, the Samkhya, and then the Advaita Vedanta, which is the one he's had a very predominating interpretation, a very dominating presence in the interpretation of Indian religion and belief because of this notion. It really kind of has been what's ensured the spread of the idea of what we were talking about with the monism before. Yoga, systematic approach to spiritual realization. Okay. As I said before, among these three are not necessarily exclusive to each other. India just doesn't work that way. Okay, it's very rare that you run across a system in India that doesn't make use of the other systems somehow. There are a couple of very materialistic systems that completely and utterly eschew these things, but they're very rare. They don't last for very long because the pliability of these other systems makes them more vibrant. So someone who, you know, someone who speaks from the point of view of the Advaita Vedanta, that there is only Brahman, there is only the Satyasya Satyam, only reality, reality, being, and being, the truth, truth. Right? They'll say, and they'll say, but you see the world order like the way the Samkhya said the world is ordered. And they practice different kinds of yoga. And so with the Samkhya, the major issue here is just to kind of know that there are basically three kinds of things, three kinds of factors that make up the world, and they interpenetrate each other and they work in different ways with each other. This stuff will all be on the website, so. We've talked actually circumscribed Advaita Vedanta. And it also, like with the Shakta, it talks about how Maya or illusion conceals reality. This Maya will come back up again in Buddhism as well. The last thing that Buddha has to do is to see through Maya before he achieves enlightenment. And in Jainism. So now we have the four yogas. There's meditative yoga, there's chakras, Raja Yoga, which is for the path of mental concentration. There's for rational people. In other words, they break this up into like different types of people, right? Raja Yoga for people who like the path of mental concentration and meditation. Jnana Yoga for people who are a rational sort and they want rational inquiry. Naturally active people have karma yoga. What we normally think of as yoga is this karma yoga. I put that picture up there ironically because this is not actually karma yoga. Okay. I respect anybody who does yoga. I've known a few people and they almost always study yoga scriptures, and I mean the ones who teach it, you know, they study yoga scriptures, they have a certain kind of life and balance in mind and all that. But in karma yoga, there's always a move and a counter move, right? So if you have a move, if you have the move like the sun, that you reach up to the sun, then you also have a counter move to bend over and reach towards the ground. In karma yoga, a yoga master will not let you go past a move and counter move until you perfected it. Notice that as soon as you go to any yoga class in the United States, you start running through every kind of move you can possibly run through. A yoga master in India starts you with the move and the counter move, and until you can perfect the move and the counter move, and it can take you 2 years, you do not move on to the next. Okay? It's supposed to be the harnessing of your active energy and the concentration and discipline of your active energy. So finally, there's bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga is the path of devotion. Okay? Now notice the differences among these. Meditative yoga usually is something you're going to do it by yourself. You're going to sit in this lotus position. Jnana yoga is something that you're going to do in rational inquiry with other people. You're going to have texts that you read. Right? You're going to have dialogues. Karma yoga, you're going to do with the master. Right? Until you slowly begin to develop through all of the systems and learn all of the basic movements. And then bhakti yoga is devotion or love to a god or a guru. Yes.
So for karma yoga, like the only
move
here,
like
are all those moves that they do actual moves in karma yoga?
Those moves are mostly all actual moves from karma yoga. I don't necessarily know that it's always. I think some of those names have been standardized. They're not actually what you'd find in Patanjali's.
But then, in actual karma yoga, each move you wouldn't get to until you accomplish the prior.
I actually small amounts of yoga, and I only do like five basic routines because the person that I had is actually Indian, and he only would allow me to learn how to do this five things. I'm not great. I try to do it to stay from falling apart, you know, being 52 is not easy. But yes, in India, they actually would take a way longer time. They had 6 months for him to teach me those five.
So it's very westernized.
Yeah, it's the, you know, what we do in the West. Everything, you know, because of globalization, everything's a freaking buffet. It's like I'll do a little bit of yoga in the morning, and then I'll do some Tai Chi, and then I'll do a little bit, you know, and sometimes I go and I study with my karate guy. And last week, you know, I was doing, you know, Christian ultimate fighting. You know, that's just how we do stuff. I think in one sense it's a holdover of our Roman ancestry. The Romans were very cosmopolitan in that kind of way. They were always up for the newest fad. Okay. So there's Patanjali, the master whose work is the basic Yoga Sutra that most people read and comment on. Yeah, Connor?
My friend is Hindu, his mom always has a red dot.
That's actually just a cosmetic beauty mark. It's supposed to mark your third eye, but it doesn't really have too much more of a meaning than beauty. Open to beauty.
Why open to
beauty? It's just something they do, you know. Why do you wear a shirt instead of a toga or whatever?
You wear
a toga? Okay. I used to actually, when I had the dreadlocks and everything I was going through one of my longer hippie phases, I used to never wear pants. I always wore sarongs, right? So I'd come into class, you know, the first day of class, and people would be like, what the heck's going on? This dude's wearing tie-dye sarongs and a shirt. It says something about Star Wars, and he's got his hair all screwed up in dreadlocks, and he's got beads and crosses, and you know, he's like, who's this? And I'd say, I'm Maggie, and I'm going to teach you some phenomenology. Let's start with my sarong. Okay, so here are the four yogas. A lot of these ideas that you see in Raja Yoga, they translate over into the other things, right? Again, it's never a full exclusivity, right? But now I want to talk a little bit about bhakti, and I'm only going to be able to talk about it for a second, because we don't really, for a little more than a second, we don't have a lot of time. I had the opportunity last semester to spend a great deal of time thinking about bhakti, about devotion, because I was in a class called Indian Philosophy and Religion and Ecology. So here's the opening line of my, I don't know if y'all know this, but the University of North Texas has the number one ranked environmental philosophy program in the world. That's what we do. We do environmental philosophy, and we're known around the world for it. We have the second highest amount of National Science Foundation, National Endowment for the Art, and private foundation grants of any philosophy department in the United States. We do lots of work on environmental ethics and environmental philosophy. I'm not an environmentalist, and I'm an existentialist. So I look at everything not as in terms of a particular problem, which is the way that academics usually work. So the first sentence of my paper was kind of a little bit of a shock, because it's not the kind of paper, it's not a sentence that you find among my peers. There's no solution to the ecological crisis. It's all, we're killing the world.
It's okay.
We're killing the world, in one sense, what it would be better to say, we're killing our habitat, because the world will last past us. Okay? there's no solution to the ecological crisis. And my argument about solution to the ecological crisis is that what we generally do is we look at everything as a problem waiting to be solved. Okay? To say there'd be such a solution claims that it's a problem, and the ecological crisis is not a problem. Rather, it is an aspect of our situation. We are situated not as beings attempting to solve a mathematical puzzle or to get around a tactical obstacle. We are situated as beings in crisis. As entities in a time of reevaluation needing to accept karmic responsibility. Now, what I want to say, let me just, this word, crisis, comes from the Greek word kritein. And when you say that something is in, when you say that something's in crisis, you should mean by that. We don't normally mean by it, because normally what we mean by crisis is, oh my God, everything's falling apart. But a crisis coming from the word kritein means that it's a time to rethink, reevaluate, and make a new judgment. To take into consideration what's going on and make a new judgment. The time of crisis is a time of judgment. Not the judgment, but a time of judgment, right? So the idea here is that we are situated as beings in crisis, as entities in a time of reevaluation needing to accept karmic responsibility. Here, the notion of karmic responsibility is to recognize that we have to accept our own debt, our own cause-effect nexus for what we've accomplished over the course of the last 500 years. Okay. Certainly, nature herself cries out under our karmic debt, but again, this is a profile of our comprehensive existential crisis. So in other words, if we're really going to not solve, but evaluate who we are, think about how we can go forward, we have to recognize that if we're in crisis, it's an existential crisis. Who are we? What are we? How are we? Why do we do what we do? It's not a particular crisis in the sense of a problem waiting to be solved. It is our very fundamental selves that we have to question. Compartmentalizing our responses and our responsibility merely repeats how Western-dominated globalization drove us into this situation and left the majority of humanity on the edge of expulsion. And what I mean by that is that humanity has become such that our own fellow human beings, when they no longer serve purpose as a natural resource within global capitalism, we're willing to just shoo them to the side. That's the refugees. That's the people who live in ghettos in our own nation. They do not matter anymore because they do not fulfill a function inside of global financial capitalism. We have expelled them, even when they're right next door to us. To engage in evaluating a new dharma, remember dharma means religion, duty, teaching. To engage in evaluating a new dharma is a transvaluation of previous values. Our revaluation must bring about a new bhakti, originary performances of devotion that arise from accepting our karmic responsibility and being forgetful of the encompassing being of being, or satyasya satyam, the truth of truth, that all things and processes are expressions of the encompassing one. You do something to one part, and it affects everything else. This is a basic Indian idea, but it's not only India who has this. So bhakti as devotion, this is what we'll talk about a little more tomorrow, because it has the inclination here too. This also appears in Jainism and it appears in Buddhism. But the basic thrust of what I'm going to be talking about is that we can learn from Indian religion that humanity needs, in this time of crisis, to develop a new devotion. And in order to develop a new devotion, it needs new kinds of teachers and not people who separate the entirety of all of our problems up into little boxes that you can solve, while the way they connect together completely allows you to miss the fact that we're still killing everything. All right? I'll see y'all tomorrow. Don't forget to bring in your myth of the moon.